Chapter 8. Ev Hillman. 1. Lead story, Bangor Daily News, July 25, 1988. Two state police disappear in Derry. Area-wide manhunt begins, by David Bright. The discovery of an abandoned state police cruiser in Derry last night, shortly after 9:30, has touched off the second major search of the summer in eastern and central Maine. The first was for 4-year-old David Brown of Haven, who is still missing. Ironically, the officers, Benton Rhodes and Peter Gabbins, were returning from that same town at the time of their disappearance, having just completed their preliminary investigation of a furnace fire which took one life. See related story this page. In a late development which one police insider described as the worst possible news we could have at this time, the body of a deer which had been shot, gutted, and cleaned was found near the cruiser, leading to speculations that... 2.
There, look at that, Beach said to Dick Allison and Newt Berenger over coffee the next morning.
They were in the Haven lunch, looking at the paper, which had just come in.
We all thought nobody would make a connection. Damn!
Relax, Newt said, and Dick nodded. No one is going to connect the disappearance of a 4-year-old boy who probably just wandered off into the woods and got picked up and driven away by a sex pervert with the disappearance of two big, strong state bears. Right, Dick?
As rain.
3.
Wrong.
4. Page 1, Bangor Daily News, below the fold. Haven Constable Killed in Freak Accident Was Community Leader, by John Leandro. Ruth McCausland, one of only 3 women constables in Maine, died yesterday in her hometown of Haven. She was 50. Richard Allison, head of Haven's volunteer fire department, says that Mrs. McCausland appears to have been killed when oil fumes, which had collected in the town hall basement as the result of a faulty valve, ignited. Allison said that the lighting in the basement, where a lot of town records are stored, is not very good. She may have struck a match, Allison said. At least, that is the theory we are going on now. Asked if any evidence of arson had been found, Allison said there had not, but admitted that the disappearance of the 2 state troopers sent to investigate the mishap, see story above, made that more difficult to determine. Since neither of the investigating officers has been able to file a report, I imagine we'll have the state fire inspectors up here. Right now, I'm more concerned that the investigating officers turn up safe and sound. Newton Berenger, Haven's head selectman, said that the entire town was in deep mourning for Mrs. McCausland. She was a great woman, Berenger said, and we all loved her. Other Haven townspeople echoed the sentiment, not a few of them in tears as they spoke of Mrs. McCausland. Her public service in the small town of Haven began in...
5.
It was, of course, Hilly's grandfather, Ev, who made the connection. Ev Hillman, who could have rightly been called the town in exile. Ev Hillman, who had come back from Big Two with 2 small steel plates in his head as a result of a German potato masher, which had exploded near him during the Battle of the Bulge. He spent the Monday morning after Haven's explosive Sunday, where he had been spending all of his mornings, in room 371 of the Derry Home Hospital, watching over Hilly. He had taken a furnished room down on Lower Main Street and spent his nights, his largely sleepless nights, there after the nurses finally turned him out. Sometimes he would lie in the dark and think he heard chuckling noises coming from the drains, and he would think, "You're going nuts, old-timer." Except he wasn't. Sometimes he wished he were. He had tried to talk to some of the nurses about what he believed had happened to David, what he knew had happened to David. They pitied him. He did not see their pity at first. His eyes were only opened after he had made the mistake of talking to the reporter. That had opened his eyes. He thought the nurses admired him for his loyalty to Hilly and felt sorry for him because Hilly seemed to be slipping away. But they also thought him mad. Little boys did not disappear during tricks performed in backyard magic shows. You didn't even have to go to nursing school to know that. After a while, in Derry, alone, half out of his mind with worry for Hilly and David, and contempt for what he now saw as cowardice on his part and fear for Ruth McCausland and the others in Haven, Ev had done some drinking at the little bar halfway down Lower Main. In the course of a conversation with the bartender, he heard the story of a fellow named John Smith, who had taught in the nearby town of Cleves Mills for a while. Smith had been in a coma for years, had awakened with some sort of psychic gift. He went nuts a few years ago, had tried to assassinate a fellow named Stilson, who was a U.S. representative from New Hampshire. "Don't know if there was ever any truth to the psychic part of it or not," the bartender said, drawing Ev a fresh beer. "Believe most of that stuff is just eyewash myself. But if you've got some wild-ass tale to tell..." Ev had hinted he had a story to tell that would make the Amityville Horror look tame. "Then Bright at the Bangor Daily News is the guy you ought to tell it to. He wrote up the Smith guy for the paper. He drops in here for a beer every once in a while. And I'll tell you, mister, he believed Smith had the sight." Ev had had three beers rapidly, one after another. Just enough, in other words, to believe that simple solutions might be possible. He went to the payphone, laid out his change on the shelf, and called the Bangor Daily News. David Bright was in, and Ev spoke to him. He didn't tell him the story, not over the phone, but said that he had a tale to tell, and he didn't understand what it all meant, but he thought people ought to know about it, fast. Bright sounded interested. More, he sounded sympathetic. He asked Ev when he could come up to Bangor. That Bright did not speak of coming to Derry to interview the old man should have tipped Ev to the idea that he might have overestimated both Bright's belief and his sympathy, and Ev had asked if that very night would be okay. "Well, I'll be here another 2 hours," Bright said. "Can you be here before midnight, Mr. Hillman?" "Bet your buns," the old man snapped and hung up. When he walked out of Wally's Spa on Lower Main, there was fire in his eye and a spring in his step. He looked 20 years younger than the man who had shuffled in. But it was 25 miles up to Bangor, and the three beers wore off. By the time Ev got to the news building, he was sober again. Worse, his head was fuzzy and confused. He was aware of telling the story badly, of circling around again and again to the magic show, to the way Hilly had looked, to his certainty that David Brown had really disappeared. At last he stopped, only it was not so much a stopping as a drying up of an increasingly sluggish flow. Bright was tapping a pencil against the side of his desk, not looking at Ev. "You never actually looked under the platform at the time, Mr. Hillman?" No, but..." Now Bright did look at him, and he had a kind face, but in it Ev saw the expression which had opened his eyes. The man thought he was just as mad as a March hare. "Mr. Hillman, all of this is very interesting." "Never mind," Ev said, getting up. The chair he had been sitting in bumped back so rapidly it almost fell over. He was dimly aware of word processor terminals tapping, phones ringing, people walking back and forth in the city room with papers in their hands. Mostly he was aware that it was midnight. He was tired and sick with fear, and this fellow thought he was crazy. "Never mind. It's late. You'll be wanting to get home to your family, I guess. Mr. Hillman, if you just see it from my perspective, you'll understand that I do see it from your side," Ev said. "For the first time, I guess. I have to go, too, Mr. Bright. I got a long drive ahead of me, and visiting hours start at 9. Sorry to have wasted your time." He got out of there fast, furiously reminding himself what he should have remembered in the first place, that there is no fool like an old fool, and he guessed tonight's work showed him off as just about the biggest old fool of all. Well, so much for trying to tell people what was happening in Haven. He was old, but he was damned if he'd ever put up with another look like that. Ever. In his life. 6. That resolution lasted exactly 56 hours, until he got a look at the headlines on Monday's papers. Looking at them, he found himself wanting to go and see the man in charge of investigating the disappearance of the two state cops. The news said that his name was Dugan, a
and mentioned that he had also known Ruth McCausland well, would, in fact, take time off from an extremely hot case to speak briefly at the lady's funeral. Must have known her pretty damned well, it seemed to Ev. But when he searched for any of the previous night's fire and excitement, he found only sour dread and hopelessness. The two stories on the front page had taken most of the guts he had left. Haven's turning into a nest of snakes, and now they are starting to bite. I have to convince someone of that, and how am I going to do it? How am I going to convince anyone that there's telepathy going on in that town, and Christ knows what else? How, when I can barely remember how I knew things were going on? How, when I never really saw nothing myself? How? Most of all, how am I supposed to do it when the whole goddamn thing is staring them in the face and they don't even see it? There's a whole town going loony just down the road, and no one has got the slightest idea it's happening.
He turned to the obituary page again. Ruth's clear eyes looked up at him from one of those strange newsprint pictures that are nothing but densely packed dots. Her eyes, so clear and straightforward and beautiful, looked calmly back at him. Ev guessed that there had been at least 5 and maybe as many as 12 men in Haven who had been in love with her, and she had never even known it. Her eyes seemed to deny the very idea of death, to declare it ridiculous. But dead she was. He remembered taking Hilly out while the search party gathered.
You could come with us, Ruthie.
Ev, I can't.
Get in touch with me.
He had tried just once, thinking that if Ruth joined him in Derry, she would be out of danger, and she could backstop his story. In his state of confusion and misery and, yes, even homesickness, Ev wasn't even sure which was more important to him. In the end, it didn't matter. He had tried 3 times to dial Haven direct, the last one after speaking to Bright, and none of the calls took. He tried once with operator assistance, and she told him there must be lines down. Would he try later? Ev said he would, but hadn't. He had lain down in the dark instead, and listened to the drains truckle. Now, less than 3 days later, Ruth had gotten in touch with him, via the obituary page. He looked up at Hilly. Hilly was sleeping. The doctors refused to call it a coma. His brain patterns were not the brain patterns of a comatose patient, they said. They were the brain patterns of a person in deep sleep. Ev didn't care what they called it. He knew Hilly was slipping away, and whether it was into a state called autism. Ev didn't know what the word meant, but he had heard one of the doctors mutter it to another in a low voice he hadn't been meant to overhear. Or one called coma didn't make any difference at all. They were just words. Slipping away was what it came down to, and that was quite terrible enough. On the ride to Derry, the boy had acted like a person in deep shock. Ev had had a vague idea that getting him out of Haven would improve matters, and in their frantic concern over David, neither Bryant nor Marie seemed to notice how odd their older boy seemed. Getting out of Derry hadn't helped. Hilly's awareness and coherence had continued to decline. The first day in the hospital, he had slept 11 hours out of 24. He could answer simple questions, but more complicated ones confused him. He complained of a headache. He didn't remember the magic show at all, and seemed to think his birthday had been only the week before. That night, sleeping deeply, he had spoken one phrase quite clearly. All the G.I. Joes. Ev's back had crawled. It was what he had been screaming over and over when they had all rushed out of the house to find David gone and Hilly in hysterics. The following day, Hilly had slept for 14 hours and seemed even more confused in his mind during the time he spent in a soupy, waking state. When the child psychologist detailed to his case asked him his middle name, he responded, Jonathan. It was David's middle name. Now he was sleeping, for all practical purposes, around the clock. Sometimes he opened his eyes, seemed even to be looking at Ev or one of the nurses. But when they spoke, he would only smile his sweet Hilly Brown smile and drift off again. Slipping away.
He lay like an enchanted boy in a fairy tale castle. Only the IV bottle over his head and the occasional PA announcements from the hospital corridor spoiling the illusion. There had been a great deal of excitement on the neurological front at first. A dark, nonspecific shadow in the area of Hilly's cerebral cortex had suggested that the boy's strange dopiness might have been caused by a brain tumor. But when they got Hilly down to X-ray again 2 days later, his plates had been slow-tracked, the X-ray technician explained to Ev, because no one expects to find a brain tumor in the head of a 10-year-old, and there had been no previous symptoms to suggest one, the shadow had been gone. The neurologist had conferred with the X-ray technician, and Ev guessed from the technician's defensiveness that feathers must have flown. The neurologist told him that one more set of plates would be taken, but he believed they would show negative. The first set, he said, must have been defective. "I suspected something must have been wacky," he told Ev. "Why was that?" The neurologist, a big man with a fierce red beard, smiled. "Because that shadow was huge. To be perfectly blunt, a kid with a brain tumor that big would have been an extremely sick child for an extremely long time, if he was still alive at all."
"I see.
And you still don't know what's wrong with Hilly?"
"We're working on 2 or 3 lines of inquiry," the neurologist said, but his smile grew vague, his eyes shifted away from Ev's, and the next day the child psychologist showed up again. The child psychologist was a very fat woman with very dark black hair. She wanted to know where Hilly's parents were.
"Trying to find their other son."
Ev expected that would squash her. It didn't.
"Call them up and tell them I'd like some help finding this one."
They came, but were no help. They had changed. They were strange. The child psychologist felt it too. And after her initial run of questions, she started to pull away from them. Ev could actually feel her doing it. Ev himself had to work hard to keep from getting up and leaving the room. He didn't want to feel their strange eyes resting on him. Their gaze made him feel as if he had been marked for something. The woman in the plaid blouse and the faded jeans had been his daughter, and she still looked like his daughter. But she wasn't. Not anymore. Most of Marie was dead, and what was left was dying rapidly. The child psychologist hadn't asked for them again. She had been in to examine Hilly twice since then. The second occasion had been Saturday afternoon, the day before the Haven Town Hall blew up.
"What were they feeding him?" she asked abruptly.
Ev had been sitting by the window, the hot sun falling on him, almost dozing. The fat woman's question startled him awake.
"What? What were they feeding him?"
"Why, just regular food," he said.
"I doubt that."
"You needn't," he said. "I took enough meals with him to know."
"Why do you ask?"
"Because 10 of his teeth are gone," she said curtly.
7.
Ev clenched a fist tightly in spite of the dull throb of arthritis and brought it down on one leg, hard.
"What are you going to do, old man? David's gone, and it would be easier if you could convince yourself he was really dead, wouldn't it?"
"Yes, that would make things simpler. Sadder, but simpler." But he couldn't believe that. Part of him was still convinced that David was alive. Perhaps it was only wishful thinking, but somehow Ev didn't think so. He had done plenty of that in his time, and this didn't feel like it. This was a strong, pulsing intuition in his mind. "David is alive. He is lost, and he is in danger of dying, oh, most certainly. But he can still be saved, if you can make up your mind to do something. And if what you make your mind up to do is the right thing."
"Long odds for an old fart like you, who pisses a dark spot on his pants every once in a while these days when he can't get to the John in time. Long, long odds."
Late Monday evening, he had awakened from a dozing sleep, trembling in Hilly's hospital room. The nurses often turned a leniently blind eye to him and allowed him to stay far past regular visiting hours. He'd had a dreadful nightmare. He had dreamed he was in some dark and stony place, needle-tipped mountains sawed at a black sky strewn with cold stars, and a wind as sharp as an ice pick whined in narrow, rocky defiles. Below him, by starlight, he could see a huge, flat plain. It looked dry and cold and lifeless. Great cracks zigzagged across it, giving it the look of crazy paving. And from somewhere, he could hear David's thin voice.
"Help me, Grandpa. It hurts to breathe. Help me. I'm scared. I didn't want to do the trick, but Hilly made me, and now I can't find my way home."
He sat looking at Hilly, his body bathed in sweat. It ran down his face like tears. He got up, went over to Hilly, and bent close to him.
"Hilly,"
he said, not for the first time,
"where's your brother? Where is David?"
Only this time Hilly's eyes opened. His watery, unseeing stare chilled Everett. It was the stare of a blind sibyl.
"Altair 4," Hilly said calmly and with perfect clarity. "David is on Altair 4, and there's Tommyknockers, knocking at the door."
His eyes slipped shut, and he slept deeply again. Ev stood over him, perfectly motionless, his skin the color of putty. After a while, he began to shudder.
8. He was the town in exile. If Ruth McCausland had been Haven's heart and conscience, then Ev Hillman, at 73, and not nearly so senile as he had lately come to fear, was its memory. He had seen much of the town in his long life there, and heard more. He had always been a good listener. Leaving the hospital that Monday evening, he detoured by the dairy Mr. Paperback, where he invested $9 in a Maine atlas, a compendium of large maps which showed the state in neat pieces, 600 square miles in each piece. Turning to map 23, he found the town of Haven. He had also bought a compass at the book and magazine shop, and now, without wondering why he was doing it, he drew a circle around the town. He did not plant the compass's anchor in Haven Village to do this, of course, because the village was actually on the edge of the township.
"David is on Altair 4. David is on Altair 4, and there's Tommyknockers, knocking at the door."
Ev sat frowning over the map and the circle he had drawn, wondering if what Hilly had said had any significance. "Should have gotten a red pencil, old man. Haven ought to be circled in red now. On this map. On every map." He bent closer. His far vision was still so perfect that he could have told a bean from a kernel of corn if you set both on a fence post 40 yards away. But his near vision was going to hell fast now, and he had left his reading glasses back at Marie and Bryant's. And he had an idea that if he went back to get them, he might find he had more to worry about than reading small print. For the time being, it was better, safer, to just get along without them. With his nose almost on the page, he examined the place where the compass point had gone in. It was Spang on the Derry Road, just a bit north of Preston Stream, and a bit east of what he and his friends had called Big Injun Woods when they were kids. This map identified them as Burning Woods, and Ev had heard that name once or twice, too. He closed the compass to a quarter of the radius he had needed to put a circle around all of Haven, and drew a second circle. He saw that Bryant and Marie's house lay just inside that circle. To the west was the short length of Nister Road, which ran from Route 9, Derry Road, to a gravel pit dead end on the edge of those same woods. Call them Big Injun Woods or Burning Woods, it was the same thing, the same woods. Nister Road. Something about Nister Road. But what? Something that had happened before he himself was born, but something that had still been worth talking of for years and years. Ev closed his eyes and looked as if he was asleep sitting up, a skinny old man, mostly bald, in a neat khaki shirt and neat khaki pants with creases up the legs. In a moment it came, and when it did he wondered how it could have taken him so long to get it. The Clarendons. The Clarendons, of course. They had lived at the junction of Nista Road and the Old Dairy Road. Paul and Faith Clarendon. Faith, who had been taken so with that Sweetie Sugar preacher, and who had birthed a child with black hair and Sweetie Sugar blue eyes about 9 months after the preacher blew town. Paul Clarendon, who had studied the baby as it lay in its crib, and who had then gotten his straight razor. Some people had shaken their heads and blamed the preacher. Colson, his name was. He said it was, anyway. Some people shook their heads and blamed Paul Clarendon. They said he'd always been crazy and Faith should never have married him. Some people had, of course, blamed Faith. Ev remembered some old man in the barbershop. This was years after, but towns like Haven have long memories. Calling her nothing but a titty-bump whore, born to make trouble. And some people had, in low voices to be sure, blamed the woods. Ev's eyes flashed open. Yes. Yes, they had. His mother called such people ignorant and superstitious, but his father only shook his head slowly and puffed his pipe and said that sometimes old stories had a grain or two of truth in them, and it was best not to take chances. It was why, he said, he crossed himself whenever a black cat crossed his path. Humph! Ev's mother had sniffed. Ev himself had then been 9 or so, he recollected now.
And I guess it's why your ma there tosses some salt over her shoulder when she spills the cellar,
Ev's dad said, mildly, to Ev.
Humph,
she said again, and went inside to leave her husband smoking on the porch and her son sitting beside him, listening intently as his father yarned. Ev had always been a good listener, except for that one crucial moment when someone had so badly needed him to listen. That one unregainable moment when he had allowed Hilly's tears to drive him away in confusion. Ev listened now. He listened to his memory. The town's memory. 9. They had been called Big Injun Woods because it was there that Chief Atlantic had died. It was the whites who called him Chief Atlantic. His proper Mi'kmaq name had been Wawevoka, which means by tall waters. Chief Atlantic was a contemptuous translation of this. The tribe had originally covered much of what was now Penobscot County, with large groups centered in Old Town, Skowhegan, and the Great Woods, which began in Ludlow. It was in Ludlow that they buried their dead when they were decimated by influenza in the 1880s and drifted south with Wawevoka, who had presided over their further decline. Wawevoka died in 1885, and on his deathbed he declared that the woods to which he had brought his dying people were cursed. That was known and reported by the two white men who had been present when he died, one an anthropologist from Boston College, the other from the Smithsonian Institution, who had come to the area in search of Indian artifacts from the tribes of the Northeast, which were degenerating rapidly and would soon be gone. What was less sure was whether Chief Atlantic was laying the curse himself or only making note of an existing condition. Either way, his only monument was the name Big Injun Woods. Even the site of his grave was no longer known. The name for that large piece of forest was, so far as Ev knew, still the one most commonly used in Haven and the other towns which were a part of it, but he could understand how the cartographers responsible for the main atlas might not have wanted to put a word like Injun in their book of maps. People had gotten touchy about such casual slurs. Old tales sometimes have a grain of truth, his dad had said. Ev, who also crossed himself when black cats crossed his path, and, truth to tell, when one looked likely to, just to be safe, thought that his dad was right, and that grain was usually there. And cursed or not, Big Injun Woods had never been very lucky. Not lucky for Wawevoka, not lucky for the Clarendons. It had never been very lucky for the hunters who tried their hand in there either, he recalled. Over the years, there had been three. Wait a minute. Ev's eyes widened, and he made a silent whistle as he thumbed through a mental card file labeled Hunting Accidents, Haven. He could just offhand think of a dozen accidents, most of them shootings, which had taken place in Big Injun Woods. A dozen hunters who had been lugged out bleeding and cursing, bleeding and unconscious, or just plain dead. Some had shot themselves, using loaded guns for crutches to help them climb over fallen trees, or dropping them, or some damn thing. One was a reputed suicide. But Ev now remembered that on two occasions, murder had been done during November in Big Engine Woods. It had been done in hot blood both times, once in an argument over a card game at someone's camp, once because of a squabble between two friends over whose bullet had taken down a buck of record-breaking size. And hunters got lost there. Christ, did they ever! Every year, it seemed, there was at least one search party went out to find some poor, scared slob from Massachusetts or New Jersey or New York, and some years there were two or three. Not all of them were found. Most were city people who had no business in the woods to start with, but that wasn't always the case. Veteran hunters said compasses worked poorly or not at all in Big Engine Woods. Ev's dad said he guessed there must be a hell of a chunk of magnetic rock buried somewhere out there, and it foozled a compass needle to hell and gone. The difference between city folks and those who were veterans of the woods was that the city folks learned how to read a compass and then put all their trust in it. So when it packed up and said east was north and west was east, or just spun around and around like a milk bottle in a kissing game, they were like men stuck in the shithouse with diarrhea and no corn cobs. Wiser men just cursed their compasses, put them away, and tried another of the half-dozen ways there were of finding a direction. Lacking all else, you looked for a stream to lead you out. Sooner or later, if you held a straight course, you'd either hit a road or a set of CMP power pylons. But Ev had known a few fellows who had lived and hunted all their lives in Maine, and who still had to be pulled by a search party, or who finally made it out on their own only by dumb luck. Delbert McCready, whom Ev had known since childhood, had been one of these. Del had gone into Big Engine Woods with his 12-gauge on Tuesday, November 10th, 1947. When 48 hours had passed and he still hadn't shown up, Mrs. McCready called Alf Tremaine, who in those days had been the constable. A search party of 20 went into the woods, where the Nista Road petered out at the Diamond Gravel Pit, and by the end of the week, it had swelled 200. They were just about to give Dell, whose daughter was, of course, Hazel McCready, up for lost when he stumbled out of the woods along the course of Preston Stream, pale and dazed and 20 pounds lighter than he had been when he went in. Ev visited him in the hospital. "How'd it happen, Dell? Night was clear. Stars were out. You can read the stars, can't you?" "Yep." Dell looked deeply ashamed. "Always could, anyway. And the moss. 'Twas you who told me about how to read north by the moss on the trees when we was kids." "Yep," Dell repeated. "Just that." Ev gave him time, then pressed. "Well, what happened?" For a long time, Dell still said nothing. Then, in a voice which was almost inaudible, he said, "I got turned around." Ev let the silence spin out, as difficult as that was. "Everything was all right for a while," Dell resumed at last. "I hunted most of the morning, but didn't see no fresh sign. I sat down and ate my dinner and had a bottle of Mama's beer. Made me sleepy, and I napped. I had some funny dreams. Can't remember 'em, but I know they was funny. And look, this happened while I was sleeping." Del McCready raised his upper lip and showed Ev a hole there.
"Lost a tooth?"
"Aye. It was laying in the crotch of my pants when I woke up. Fell out when I was sleeping, I guess. But I ain't hardly ever had any trouble with my teeth, at least not since that one wisdom tooth got impacted and damn near killed me. By then, it coming on dark."
"Dark?
I know how it sounds, don't you worry," Dell said crossly, but it was the crossness of someone who was deeply ashamed. "I just slept all the afternoon away, and when I got up, Ev—" His eyes rolled up to meet Ev's for one miserable second and then shifted away, as if he could not bear to look his old friend in the eye for longer than that one second. "It was like something stole my brains." "The tooth fairy, mayhap." Dell laughed, but there hadn't been much humor in the sound. I wandered around for a while, thinking I was following the pole star, and when I still hadn't come out on the Hammercut Road by 9 o'clock or so, I kind of rubbed my eyes and saw it wasn't Polaris at all, but one of the planets, Mars or Saturn, I guess. I laid down to sleep, and until I came out along Preston Stream a week later, I don't remember nothing but little bits and pieces.
Well, Ev halted.
It sounded entirely unlike Dell, whose head was as level as a carpenter's plane.
Well, was you panicked, Dell?
Dell's eyes rolled up to meet Ev's, and they were still ashamed, but there was also a leaven of real humor in them now.
A man can't stay in a panic for a whole week, I don't believe, he said dryly. It's awful tiring.
So you just...
I just, Dell agreed.
But just what? I don't know.
I know that when I woke up from that nap, my feet and my ass was both asleep and all numb. And I know that in one of those dreams it seemed like I heard something humming. The way you can hear power lines hum on a still day, you know. And that's all. I forgot all my woodcraft and wandered around the woods like somebody who'd never even seen the woods before. When I hit Preston Stream, I knew enough to follow it out, and I woke up in here. And I guess I'm a laughingstock in town, but I'm grateful to be alive. It's God's mercy that I am.
You ain't a laughingstock, Dell, Ev said. And, of course, that was a lie, because that was exactly what Dell was.
He worked at overcoming it for nearly 5 years. And when he saw for sure that the barbershop wits were never going to let him live it down, he moved up to East Eddington and opened a combination garage and small engine repair shop. Ev still got up to see him once in a while, but Dell didn't come down to Haven much anymore. Ev guessed he knew why.
10. Sitting in his rented room, Ev closed the compass up as tight as it would go and drew the tiniest circle yet, the smallest the compass would make. There was only one house inside this marble-sized circle, and he thought, that house is the closest one there is to the center of Haven. Funny I never thought about it before. It was the old Garrick place, sitting there on Derry Road with Big Engine Woods widening out behind it. Should have drawn this last circle in red, if no other. Frank's niece Bobby Anderson lived on the Garrick place now. Not that she farmed, of course. She wrote books. Ev hadn't passed many words with Bobby, but she had a good reputation in town. She paid her bills on time, folks said, and didn't gossip. Also, she wrote good old Western stories that you could really sink your teeth into, not all full of make-believe monsters and a bunch of dirty words, like the ones that fella who lived up in Bangor wrote. Goddamn good Westerns, people said. Especially for a girl. People in Haven felt good about Bobby Anderson. But, of course, she'd just been in town for 13 years, and people would have to wait and see. Garrick, most agreed, had been as crazy as a shithouse rat. He always brought in a good garden, but that didn't change his mental state. He was always trying to tell someone about his dreams. They were usually about the second coming. After a while, it got so that even Arlene Cullum, who sold Amway with the zeal of a Christian martyr, would make herself scarce when she saw Frank Garrick's truck plastered with bumper stickers which said things like, if the rapture's today, somebody grab my steering wheel, driving down the village's main street. In the late 60s, the old man had gotten a bee in his bonnet about flying saucers. Something about Elijah seeing a wheel within a wheel and being taken up to heaven by angels driving chariots of fire powered by electromagnetism. He had been crazy, and he had died of a heart attack in 1975. But before he died, Ev thought with rising coldness, he lost all his teeth. I noticed it, and I remember Justin Hurd just down the road commenting on it, and now Justin's the closest, except for Bobby herself, that is. And Justin also wasn't what you'd call a model of sanity and reason. A few times I saw him before I left, he even reminded me of old Frank.
It was odd, he thought at first, that he had never put together the run of peculiar things that had happened within those two inner circles before, that no one had. Further reflection made him decide it really wasn't so strange after all. A life, particularly a long one, was composed of millions of events. They made a crowded tapestry with many patterns woven into it. Such a pattern as this, the deaths, the murders, the lost hunters, crazy Frank Garrick, maybe even that queer fire at the Polsons, only showed up if you were looking for it. Once seen, you wondered how you could have missed it. But if you weren't. And now a new thought dawned. Bobby Anderson was perhaps not all right. He remembered that since the beginning of July, perhaps even before, there had been sounds of heavy machinery coming from Big Engine Woods. Ev had heard the sounds and dismissed them. Maine was heavily forested, and the sounds were all too familiar. New England paper doing a spot of logging on its land, most likely. Except now that he thought about it, now that he had seen the pattern, Ev realized that the sounds weren't deep enough in the woods to be on NEP's land. Those sounds were coming from the Garrick place. And he also realized that the earlier sounds, the cycling, waspy whine of a chainsaw, the crackle crunch of falling trees, the coughing roar of a gas-powered chipper, had given way to sounds he didn't associate with woods work at all. The later sounds had been, what, earth-moving machinery, perhaps. Once you saw the pattern, things fell into place like the last dozen pieces going effortlessly into a big jigsaw puzzle. Ev sat looking down at the map and the circles. A numbing horror seemed to be filling his veins, freezing him from the inside out. Once you saw the pattern, you couldn't help seeing it. Ev slammed the atlas shut and went to bed. 11. Where he was unable to sleep. What are they doing down there tonight? Building things? Making people disappear? What? Every time he drifted near sleep, an image came. Everyone in Haven Village standing in Main Street with drugged, dreamy expressions on their faces, all of them looking southwest, toward those sounds, like Muslims facing Mecca to pray. Heavy machinery. Earth-moving machinery. As the pieces went into the puzzle, you began to see what it was, even if there was no picture on the box to help you. Lying in his narrow bed not far from where Hilly lay in his coma, Ev Hillman thought he saw the picture pretty well. Not all of it, mind you, but a lot. He saw it and knew perfectly well no one would believe him. Not without proof. And he dared not go back, dared not put himself in their reach. They would not let him go a second time. Something. Something out in Big Engine Woods. Something in the ground. Something on the land Frank Garrick had willed to his niece, who wrote those Western books. Something that knocked compasses and human minds galley west if you got too close. For all Ev knew, there might be such strange deposits all over the earth. If it did nothing else, it might explain why people in some places seem so goddamn pissed off all the time. Something bad. Haunted. Maybe even accursed. Ev stirred restlessly, rolled over, looked at the ceiling. Something had been in the earth. Bobby Anderson had found it, and she was digging it up, her and that fella who was staying out at the farm with her. That fella's name was... Ev groped, but couldn't come up with it. He remembered the way Beach Jernigan's mouth had thinned when the subject of Bobby's friend came up one day in the Haven lunch. The regulars on coffee break had just observed the man coming out of the market with a bag of groceries. He had a place over in Troy, Beach said, a shacky little place with a wood stove and plastic over the windows. Someone said he'd heard the fellow was educated. Beach said an education never kept anyone from being no account. No one in the lunch had argued the point, Ev remembered. Nancy Voss had been equally disapproving. She said Bobby's friend had shot his wife, but had been let off because he was a college professor. If you got a sheepskin written in Latin words in this country, you can get away with anything, she had said. They had watched the fellow get into Bobby's truck and drive back toward the old Garrick place. I heard he done majored in drinking. old Dave Rutledge said from the end stool that was his special place. Everyone goes out there says he's most all as drunk as a coon on stump liquor. There had been a burst of mean, gossipy country laughter at that. They hadn't liked Bobby's friend. None had. Why? Because he had shot his wife? Because he drank? Because he was living with a woman he wasn't married to? Ev knew better. There had been men in the lunch that day who had not just beaten their wives, but beaten them into entirely new shapes. Out here it was part of the code. You were obligated to put one upside the old woman's head if she got smat. Out here were men who lived on beer from 11 in the morning until 6 at night, and cheap green front whiskey from 6 to midnight, and would drink old woodsman's fly dope strained through a snot rag if they couldn't afford whiskey. Men who had the sex lives of rabbits jumping from hole to hole. And what had his name been? Ev drifted toward sleep. Saw them standing on the sidewalks, on the lawn of the public library, over by the little park, staring dreamily toward those sounds. Snapped awake again.
What did you find out, Ruth? Why did they murder you?
He tossed onto his left side.
David's alive. But to bring him back, I have to start in Haven.
He tossed onto his right side.
They'll kill me if I go back. There was once a time when I was almost as well liked there as Ruth herself. At least I always liked to think so. Now they hate me. I saw it in their eyes the night they started looking for David. I took Hilly out because he was sick and needed the doctor, yes. But it was damn good to have a reason to go. Maybe they only let me go because David distracted them. Maybe they just wanted to be rid of me. Either way, I was lucky to get out. I'd never get out again. So how can I go back? I can't.
Ev tossed and turned, caught on the horns of two imperatives. He would have to go back to Haven if he wanted to rescue David before David died. But if he went back to Haven, he would be killed and buried quickly in someone's backfield. Sometime shortly before midnight, he fell into a troubled doze, which quickly deepened into the dreamless sleep of utter exhaustion. 12. He slept later than he had in years, awakening on Tuesday at 10:15. He felt refreshed and whole for the first time in a long while. The sleep had done him a power of good, too. During it, he had thought of how he could maybe get back into Haven and out again. Maybe. For David's sake, and Hilly's. That was the risk he would take. He thought he could get in and out of Haven on the day of Ruth McCausland's funeral. 13. Butch Monster Dugan was the biggest man Ev had ever seen. Ev believed that Justin Hurd's father Henry might have been within a shout. Henry had stood 6'6", weighed 380 pounds, and had shoulders so broad he had to go through most doors sideways. But Ev thought this fellow was a tad bigger. 20 or 30 pounds lighter, maybe, but that was all. When Ev shook his hand, he saw that word on him had been getting around. It was in Dugan's face. "Sit down, Mr. Hillman," Dugan said, and seated himself in a swivel chair that looked as if it might have been rammed out of a huge oak. "What can I do for you?"
"He expects me to start raving," Ev thought calmly, "just the way we always expected Frank Garrick to start when he caught up to one of us on the street. And I guess I ain't going to disappoint him. But if you step careful, Ev, you may still get your way. You know now where you want to go, anyway."
"Well, maybe you could do something at that," Ev said.
At least he hadn't been drinking. Trying to talk to that reporter after those beers had been a bad mistake.
"Paper says you'll be going to Ruth McCausland's funeral tomorrow."
Dugan nodded. "I'm going. Ruth was a personal friend."
"And there are others from Derry Barracks that'll be going. Paper said her husband was a trooper, and she was in the line of police work herself. Oh, being a town constable's no great shakes, I know, but you get what I mean. There will be others, won't there?"
Dugan was frowning now, and he had a lot of face to frown with.
"Mr. Hillman,
If you have a point to make, I'm not getting it. And I'm a busy man this morning, in case you didn't know it, his face added. I've got 2 cops missing. It's starting to look more and more like they ran into some guys jacking deer, and the jackers panicked and shot them. I'm on the hot seat on that one. And on top of it all, my old friend Ruth McCausland has died, and I don't have either the time or the patience for bullshit.
I know you're not, but you will. Did she have other friends who will be going?
Yes, 6 or more. I'm going by myself, starting a little early so I can talk to some people about a related case. Ev nodded.
I know about the related case, he said, and I guess you know about me.
Or think you do.
Mr. Hillman, I have talked foolishly and to the wrong people and at the wrong times, Ev said in that same calm voice. Under other circumstances, I would have known better, but I've been upset. One of my grandsons is missing. The other is in a sort of coma.
Yes, I know.
I've been so confused, I haven't really known if I was coming or going. So I blabbed to some of the nurses, and then I went up to Brangger and talked to a reporter. Bright. I kind of got the idea you'd heard most of the things I had to say to him.
I understand you believe there was some sort of conspiracy in the matter of David Brown's disappearance. Ev had to struggle to keep from laughing. The word was both bizarre and apt. He never would have thought of it himself. Oh, there was a conspiracy going on, all right. One hell of a conspiracy.
Yes, sir. I believe there was a conspiracy, and I think you've got 3 cases that are a lot more related than you understand. The disappearance of my grandson, the disappearance of those 2 troopers, and the death of Ruth McCausland, my friend as well as yours.
Dugan looked a bit startled, and for the first time that dismissive look went out of his eyes. For the first time, Ev felt that Dugan was really seeing him, Everett Hillman, instead of just some crazy old rip who had blown in to fart away part of his morning.
"Perhaps you'd better give me the gist of what you believe," Dugan said, and took out a pad of paper.
"No, you could just put that pad away." Dugan looked at him silently for a moment. He didn't put the pad away, but he put down the pencil.
"Bright thought I was crazy, and I didn't tell him 1/2 of what I thought," Ev said. "So I ain't going to tell you any. But here's the thing. I think David's still alive. I don't think he's in Haven anymore, but I think if I went back there, I might be able to get an idea on where he is. Now, I have reasons, pretty good ones, I think, to believe that I'm not wanted in Haven. I have reasons to think that if I went back there under most circumstances, I'd most likely disappear like David Brown. Or have an accident, like Ruth."
Butch Dugan's face changed.
"I think," he said, "I got to ask you to explain that, Mr. Hillman."
"I ain't going to. I can't. I know what I know and believe what I believe, but I ain't got a speck of proof. I know how crazy I must sound, but if you look into my face, you'll know one thing at least. I believe what I'm saying."
Dugan sighed.
"Mr. Hillman, if you were in this business, you'd know how sincere most liars look."
Ev started to say something, and Dugan shook his head.
"Forget that, cheap shot. I've only had about 6 hours sleep since Sunday night. I'm getting too old for these marathons. Fact is, I do believe you're sincere. But you're only making ominous sounds, talking around the edges of things. Sometimes people do that when they're scared, but mostly they do it when edges are all they have. Either way, I haven't got time to woo you. I answered your questions. Maybe you'd better state your business."
"Glad to. I came here for 2 reasons, Trooper Dugan. First one was to make sure there was going to be a lot of cops in Haven tomorrow. Things are less likely to happen when there are a lot of cops around, don't you agree?"
Dugan said nothing, only looked at Ev expressionlessly.
"Second was to tell you I'll be in Haven tomorrow, too. I won't be at Ruth's funeral, though. I'm going to have a Very pistol with me, and if, during that funeral, you or any of your men should see a big old star shell go off in the sky, you'll know I have run afoul of some of that craziness no one will believe. Do you follow me?
You said going back to Haven might be, unhealthy for you.
Dugan's face was still blank, but that didn't matter. Ev knew he had gone back to his original idea. Ev was crazy, after all.
Under most circumstances, I said. Under these circumstances, I think I can get away with it.
Ruth was loved in Haven, which is a fact I don't think I have to tell you. Most of the town will turn out to see her into the ground. I don't know if they still loved her when she died, but that don't matter. They'll turn out anyway.
How do you figure that? Dugan asked. Or is that another one of those things you don't want to talk about?
No, I don't mind. It would look wrong if they didn't turn out.
To who?
To you. To the other policemen who were friends to her and her husband. To the Pauls from the Penobscot County Democratic Committee.
Why, 'twouldn't surprise me if Congressman Brennan sent someone up from Augusta. She worked awful hard for him when he ran for office in Washington. She wasn't just local, you see. That's part of what they got to deal with. They're like people who don't want to throw a party, but who are stuck doing it just the same. I'm hoping they'll be so busy making things look right, with putting on a good show, that they'll not even know I've been in Haven until I'm gone.
Butch Dugan crossed his arms over his chest. Ev had been close to the truth. At first, Dugan had indulged himself in the fancy that David Bright, who was usually an accurate interpreter of human behavior, had been wrong this time. Hillman was as sane as he was. Now he was mildly disturbed, not because Hillman had turned out to be crazy after all, but because he had turned out to be really crazy. And yet, there was something oddly persuasive in the old man's calm, reasonable voice and his steady gaze.
"You speak as if everyone in Haven was in on something," Dugan said. "And I think that's impossible. I want you to know that."
"Yes, any normal person would say that. That's how they've been able to get away with it this long. 50 years ago, people felt like the atomic bomb was impossible, and they would have laughed at the idea of TV, let alone a video recorder."
"Not much changes, Trooper Dugan. Most people see as far as the horizon, and that's all. If someone says there's something over it, people don't listen."
Ev stood up and extended his hand over Dugan's desk, as if he had every right in the world to expect Dugan to shake it, which surprised Butch into doing just that.
"Well, I knew when I looked at you that you thought I was nuts," Ev said with a rueful little smile, "and I guess I've said enough to double that idea. But I've found out what I needed to know and said what I needed to say. I'll do an old man a favor and peek at the sky once in a while. If you see a purple star shell..."
"The woods are dry this summer," Dugan said, and even as the woods came out of his mouth, they seemed helpless and oddly unimportant, almost frivolous. He realized he was being drawn helplessly toward belief again. Dugan cleared his throat and pushed on. "If you've really got a flare gun, using it could start a hell of a forest fire. If you don't have a permit to use such a thing, and I know goddamn well you don't, it could get you thrown into jail." Ev's grin widened a little, but there was still no humor in it.
"If you see the star shell," he said, "I got a feeling that being thrown into the pokey up to Bangor is going to be the least of my worries. Good day to you, Trooper Dugan."
Ev stepped out and closed the door neatly behind him. Dugan stood for a moment, as perplexed and uneasy as he had ever been in his life. "Let him go," he thought, and then got moving. Something had been troubling Butch Dugan. The disappearance of the two troopers, both of whom he had known and liked, had temporarily driven it out of his mind. Hillman's visit had brought it back, and that was what sent him after the old man. It was the memory of his last conversation with Ruth. He had been worried about her even before then. Her handling of the David Brown search hadn't been like the Ruth McCausland he knew at all. For the only time he could remember, she had been unprofessional. Then, the night before she died, he had called her about the investigation, to get information and to give it. To Kibitz, in short.
He knew neither of them had anything, but sometimes you could spin something out of plain speculation, like straw into gold. In the course of that conversation, the subject of the boy's grandfather had come up. By then, Butch had spoken to David Bright of the news, had had a beer with him, in fact, and passed on to Ruth Ev's idea that the whole town had gone crazy in some strange way. Ruth hadn't laughed at the story, or clucked over the failure of Ev Hillman's mind, as he had expected she would do. He wasn't sure just what she had said, because just about then the connection had begun to get bad. Not that there was anything very unusual in that. Most of the lines going into small towns like Haven were still on poles and the connections regularly went to hell. All it took was a high wind to make you feel like you and the other person were holding tomato soup cans connected by a length of wax string. Better tell him to stay away, Ruth had said. He was sure of that much. And then, just before he lost her altogether, it seemed to him that she had sensed something about, of all things, nylon stockings. He must have heard her wrong, but there was no mistaking the tone. Sadness and great weariness, as if her failure to find David Brown had taken all the heart out of her. A moment later, the connection had broken down completely. He hadn't bothered to call her back because he had given her all the information he had. Precious little, really. The next day she was dead. Better tell him to stay away. That much he was sure of. Now I have reasons to believe that I'm not wanted in Haven. Tell him to stay away. I might disappear like David Brown. Stay away. Or have an accident like Ruth McCausland. Away. He caught up to the old man in the parking lot. 14. Hillman had an old purple Valiant with badly rusted rocker panels. He looked up, driver's side door open, as Dugan loomed over him. I'm coming with you tomorrow. Ev's eyes widened. You don't even know where I'm going. No, but if I'm with you, I won't have to worry that you're going to set half the woods in eastern Maine on fire trying to send me a message like 007. Ev looked at him consideringly, and then shook his head. I'd feel better having someone with me, he said, especially a guy as big as Gorilla Monsoon who packs a gun. But they ain't stupid in Haven, Officer Dugan. They never were, and I got a feeling that they're a lot less stupid just lately. They expect to see you at her funeral. If they don't, they're going to be suspicious. Christ, I'd like to know how the hell you can stand there babbling all that crazy shit and sound so fucking sane. Maybe because you know too, Ev said. How funny it is. How funny all these things started in Haven. Then, with a prescience that was startling, he added, Or maybe you knew Ruth well enough yourself to sense she'd gotten off kilter. The two men stood looking at each other in the graveled parking lot of the Dairy Barracks, the sun beating down on them, their shadows, clear and black, slanting out neatly at 2 o'clock. I'll let on tonight that I'm sick, Dugan said, that I've got stomach flu. It's been going around the barracks. What do you think? Ev nodded with sudden relief. That relief was so great it was startling. The idea of sneaking back into Haven had frightened him more than he had been willing to let on, especially to himself. He had half convinced this big cop that something might be going on there. He could see it in his face. Half convinced wasn't much, maybe, but it was still a giant step forward from where he had been. And, of course, he hadn't done it alone. Ruth McCausland had helped. All right, he said. But listen to me, Trooper Dugan, and listen good, because our lives could depend on it tomorrow. Don't you call up any of the men who will be going to the funeral tomorrow and tell them the reason you're not going to be there is just a gag you're running. Call up a few people tonight and tell them you really are just as sick as a dog, that you hope you're going to be able to make it, but you doubt it. Dugan frowned. Well, why would you want me to say? But suddenly he knew, and his mouth dropped open. The old man stared back at him calmly enough. Christ Jesus, are you telling me that you think the people in Haven are mind readers? That if my men knew I really wasn't sick, the people in town could pick the news right out of their heads?
I ain't telling you a thing, Trooper Dugan, Ev said. You are telling me.
Mr. Hillman, I really think you must be imagining. I never expected you'd want to come with me when I came to see you. I wasn't angling for it, either. The most I hoped for was that you'd keep an eye out and see my flare if I got in trouble. And that would at least keep the heat on that nest of snakes down there a while longer. But if you offer a man more, he wants more.
Trust me a little further, please, for Ruth's sake. If that's what it takes to convince you to come with me, I'm willing to use it. Something else. No matter what, you're going to feel some peculiar things tomorrow.
I've felt some pretty peculiar ones today, Dugan said.
I am,
Ev said, and waited for Dugan to decide. Do you have some actual place to go in mind? Dugan asked after a moment. Or are you just going to ramble around the town until you get tired of it?
I've got a place in mind, Ev said quietly. He thought, oh, yes. Yes, siree, Bob. Up behind the old Garrick place on the outskirts of Big Injun Woods, where compasses have never worked worth a tin shit in a gold mine. And I believe we'll strike on a pretty good path through the woods to it, whatever it is, because equipment like the stuff Bobby Anderson and a friend have been using leaves a back trail as wide as a freeway. No, I don't believe there will be any trouble finding it at all.
Okay. Give me the address of the place you're staying in, Derry, and I'll pick you up at 9 in my personal car. We'll get to Haven just about the time the service starts.
The car's my treat, Ev said quietly. Not this one. It's known in Haven. I'll have a rental. And you'll want to show up at 8, because we'll be doing a bit of back roading.
I can get us into Haven and still keep clear of the village, Dugan said. You don't have to worry about that.
I ain't. But I want us to skirt the whole town and come in from the Albion side, and I think I know just the way to do it.
Why the hell does it have to be that end of town?
Because it's the furthest from where they'll be, and that's where I want to come back into Haven, as far from them as I can get.
You're really scared, aren't you?
Ev nodded.
Why a rental car?
Criminy, don't you ask a lot of questions.
And Ev rolled his eyes in such a comical way that Butch Dugan grinned. It's my job, he said. Why do you want to go on a rental? No one in Haven is going to know my personal car. He paused, thinking. At least, not now that Ruth's dead.
Because it's my obsession, Ev Hillman said. His face suddenly cracked into a smile of startling sweetness. And a person ought to pay the freight on his own obsession.
All right, Butch said. I give up. 8 o'clock, your route, your car, your obsession. I must be crazy. I really must be.
By tomorrow at this time, I think you're going to have a much better idea of what crazy is, Ev said, and climbed into his old purple Valiant before Dugan could ask him any more questions.
Butch, in fact, had no more questions to ask. He felt glum, as if he had bought the Brooklyn Bridge his first day in New York City, shelling out even though he knew a thing that big probably couldn't be for sale. No one gets taken who doesn't want to be taken, he thought. He had worked fraud and bunco out of Augusta for 3 years, and that was the first thing they taught you. The old man had been queerly persuasive. But Butch Dugan knew that he had not been persuaded into this. He had jumped, because he had loved Ruth McCausland, and in another year or so, he probably would have plucked up sufficient nerve to propose to her. Because when someone you love dies, it leaves a black hole in the middle of your heart, and one way to plug such a hole is to refuse to admit that he or she was taken away by a stupid mischance. Better if you can believe, even for a little while, that someone or something you can get hold of was responsible. It makes the hole a little smaller. Even a rube knows that much. Sighing, suddenly feeling much older than his age, Dugan trudged back to the barracks. Ev went to the hospital and sat for most of that day's remainder with Hilly. Around 3 o'clock, he wrote 2 notes. One he put on Hilly's night table, anchored against the breeze that pawed with occasional playfulness through the open window with a little pot of flowers. The other note was longer, and when he had done with it, he folded it and put it in his pocket. Then he left the hospital. He drove to a small building in the Derry Industrial Park. Maine Med Supplies, the sign over the door read, and below that, specializing in respiration supplies and respiration therapy since 1946. He told the man inside what he wanted. The man told him it sounded as if he really ought to take a ride up to Bangor and talk to the folks at Down East Scuba Dive. Ev explained that a scuba tank was the last thing he wanted. He was interested in as much dry land portability as he could get. He and the fellow talked a while longer, and Ev left after signing a 36-hour rental agreement with a rather specialized piece of equipment. The fellow at Maine Med Supplies stood at the door watching him go, scratching his head. 15. The nurse read the note by Hilly's bed. Hilly, I may not see you for a while now, but I just wanted to tell you I think you'll get over this bad patch, and if I can help you do it, I guess I will be just about the happiest grandpa in the world. I believe David is still alive, and I don't think it's your fault that he got lost in the first place. I love you, Hilly, and I hope to see you soon. Gramp. But he never saw Hilly Brown again.